Institute. Dishing It Out with Gary O'Hanlon and Gareth Mullins, a Go Loud original podcast.
Proudly sponsored by Johnstone Fine Foods. Buy premium Irish dry-aged beef at johnstonebeef.com.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us.
Welcome to another episode of Dishing It Out with me, Gary O'Hanlon.
And me, Gareth Mullins.
And coming up on today's show, we will have child psychologist Dr. David Coleman joining us. Should be a nice bit of insight from him, Gareth, you being a parent and me as well. He's
And you know, he wasn't hugely on my radar, if I'm being honest. And then as soon as I didn't actually follow him on socials, but I knew him from all the stuff he does across the different mediums of radio and TV. And I've since followed him. And he's brilliant, isn't he? He has a real kind of calming voice.
It's mad, actually.
So I'm really looking forward to that. I'm sure it's going to be...
His videos on Instagram are good. I often sort of glaze over them whenever I see them, you know what I mean? Because, like, you know, not everything relates, but... You know, it's always, it's just something reassuring about that voice or whatever. He's currently in the middle of a nationwide tour as well. So we'll probably ask him where he's popping up around the country, and maybe people can go and have a listen to him. So that should be good. We will be doing our culinary conundrums as always. So don't go anywhere. So guys, you're going to do the recipe of the week this week, I believe.
Yeah, and we went through all the different bits and pieces in the boxes, but I'm going to do beef mince just because I think we've done so much talking about beef. It's so important, I think, that we touch mince, because I think a lot of families and a lot of listeners are cooking mince. I mean, it's obviously very good value for money, but I would still say quality is really important. There's a lot of cheap mince in the supermarkets. So what I would say to you is pick one that's not too lean. Like, I think the really lean stuff kind of hides a little bit of flavour. And I'm going to give you a really quick recipe for a shepherd's pie, because I made a couple of them last week and I forgot how delicious they are, you know. So I think it's the change in the season. But
I think we were chatting, somebody do shepherd's pie as a last supper. I went home and made one.
Did you? So did I. So that must have been it.
Yeah, I think that's what it was.
That must have been it. So what you're going to need, obviously, is some beef mince. You need some onions, some celery, and some carrot. And then you need a few herbs. So I would say a bay leaf.
What about peas? Don't tell me you don't.
At the end.
Peas.
At the end, well, I put the peas in. Will you, Bladen, calm down there? Who's doing the recipe?
Yeah, but you've got to dish out your ingredients, man. Dish out
let me finish. Yeah, you need some peas. Or do you know what? Maybe you don't need.
I thought it was going to be like a fancy Dublin shepherd.
No. You need peas right in at the end. And then you need the one ingredient that you have to have, in my view, is Worcestershire sauce. Because if you don't season it with Worcestershire sauce, then to me, it's not a shepherd's pie.
It's not even real.
Yeah, exactly. You need a couple of stock cubes, and you need a nice creamy mashed potato to go on the top. But the one little pro tip that I'm going to give you is when you fry off your mince at the start, you have to cook it for longer than you think. So caramelizing that mince at the start is really where you're going to find the flavor in the sauce. So a wide based casserole dish, put your mince in and a little bit of vegetable oil and fry it until it starts. I want you to think about, like, when we talk about caramelizing a steak or searing off a piece of meat, you're going to do that with the mince, and then you're going to break it up and keep frying it. And what happens is the oil that's in the mince will leach out. First, there might be a little bit of water, and then it'll start frying in its own beef fat, if you like. And that's really where all the flavor is. Take your mince back out of the pan, and then you're going to go in with your onions that have been finely chopped, your celery finely chopped, and your carrots. Cook that off. Then you're going to go in with your thyme and your bay leaf, and then you can go back in with your mince with some tomato puree, a tin of chopped tomatoes, and then you're going to cook that out with your beef stock cube and some water for, I don't know, like a half an hour, 40 minutes to thicken up the sauce. At that point, plenty of cracked black pepper, and season it with the Worcestershire sauce. So all I'm saying is add in like 10 or 15 little glugs of Worcestershire. Taste it. When you think you have enough, I'd even go in with a little bit more. Like, you nearly want to over-season it. And then, especially for Gary, turn off the stove, throw in your frozen peas, take it off the heat, put it into a dish, bottom of a dish, and then let it go nice and cold, and then you're going to dollop on. If you're in Gary's house, you're probably going to get a piping bag and you're going to pipe your mash on like the pure pro that he is.
You better believe it.
Or you can just dollop it on, and then it goes into a preheated oven at 180 degrees. And it really is a wonderful dish. I'm actually going to be sharing, the last time when I made it, I done a video. I'm going to share it on my Instagram.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go. Gary has still yet to share anything on his Instagram, even though
I know
he will. In the
My
coming
agent's
weeks.
Losing their mind because exactly. I'm not doing enough food stuff. And just to be, you know, don't bother sending us in little emails saying that it's not a shepherd's pie if it's not made with minced lamb. Nobody makes it with lamb. All right? Nobody.
Yeah, really? It's a, it is.
Shepherd's
yeah.
pie is lamb. It's not, it's cottage
yeah,
pie.
Yeah, it's beef. Cottage pie. Yeah.
But
now, well,
everybody makes a shepherd's pie with.
Yeah,
beef.
It is a cottage pie. But now I make it with. Exactly.
Yeah, and we call what we want because we're the chefs. We're the chefs and it's our show.
Exactly.
So we can do what we want.
So yeah, no, it's a cracker and it's the right time of year to make it. And look, it's one of those ones as well for batch cooking. Make a heap of them and throw them in the freezer.
Yeah. Okay, so Gareth and I would pretty much say that we're one of these as well because we're parents to, he's parents to two animals. I've got three rascals and so on. But no, jokes aside, we decided to go with an absolute professional in this field of clinical psychology and Dr. David Coleman, who many of you will know from lots of his different TV shows and his brilliant little videos. I'm a follower. If anybody follows him on Instagram, he's always dishing out some amazing little anecdotes and little tricks of the trade to help families along. David, you're very welcome to dishing it out. Normally we've got somebody in studio here, but you're living in the beautiful west of Ireland, I believe, now, and doing some all your works from home. David, is it,
you know, over the last whatever 10 or 12 years, I mean I used to work with the HSE and I used to work in Ennis, but then I think probably because of the stuff I was doing on TV and radio and all the bits way back in the day, I didn't really have time to do full-time work with the HSE, so I kind of moved part-time and then eventually gave it up altogether. And so I do a bit of private practice and then all the various bits and pieces that are associated with all the media bits.
Yeah. So, doctor, then bring us back to the early days. Like, what made you go down this route, like, of clinical psychology? And is it, is it all work mostly with children, or is it with all ages and demographics?
Yeah, I'm not sure what drew me to psychology. I think I'd always had some kind of vague, fond notion that I'd be doing some kind of job or work, you know, with people, and I think maybe helping people. I don't think it ever really crystallized. I don't think I really understood what a clinical psychologist was until I was in college, and I started studying psychology in college, but I was heading down a research route for a number of years, and I just started doing a PhD in neuropsychology, which was looking at various things associated with multiple sclerosis. In fact, it was the project that I was going to be working on. And I suddenly had this kind of epiphany moment where I thought, geez, I don't think I really want to be doing this. I don't think I want to be doing research. I think I was quite good at it, but I don't think I really enjoyed it. And and so then I shifted and I moved into clinical psychology. And I think that's when I finally just suddenly had this moment where I thought, okay, now this all starts to make sense, because I think it was about really the application of psychology. And it was interesting, the guy who was the director of the training course that I did, I remember he said, you know, the job of psychology, really the job of a psychologist is to give psychology away. And I think that actually has stuck with me. Because it just makes the most sense that, you know, there's a lot of information and knowledge kind of stored up through research and various different things in psychology. And most people don't have access to it because sometimes it can be very jargony. Sometimes the research is really, really specific. And so when I had this opportunity to do TV stuff way back, it felt like, okay, now actually this really makes sense, because now lots of people can have access to this information that I feel I have and that I feel is, useful and helpful for people. But I think that, you know, sometimes it really does need to be translated. I think it needs to be accessible in the language that we use, and that it just kind of makes sense to people. One of my best friends often says to me, well, now, David, you do know, like, everything you do, like, you're really just talking common sense, aren't you? I suppose, you know, it kind of is what I do. Certainly in my public profile, you know, a lot of it I think does come across as common sense, but that's not to say that that's necessarily always immediately available or on people's minds, you know, in terms of how they might interact with their kids. But now, certainly in my private practice, I only work with teenagers, actually. I've moved, shifted a little bit over the last number of years, and probably to do with my own kids as they've grown up and the stages they've been at. And I mean, they're all moved on now. They're all adults and currently all in Dublin. Although one of them's about to head off to the States for a year, but So now I work with teenagers. That's a very long
answer. David, can I ask you, when would you, or when should one think to see a psychologist? Like, just as a, you know, there's a lot of people use them now, and I think from time to time they can say, you know, like the American culture that everybody has to go and see one at some point. But I definitely feel, certainly in my life across the last 15 or 20 years, I've seen a lot of my friends and family, and certainly loads of my work colleagues reach into that world much more comfortably. And I don't think there's as much of a, it's not as much of a negative connotation anymore. It's certainly to make oneself better. So in your view, when should somebody reach? Is it when there's a problem or before that?
So certainly when it comes to kids and teenagers, one of my kind of guiding principles is if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Right.
Because I think, you know, there's a lot of stuff that goes on for teenagers and children that actually is just very much part of their normal development. And, you know, kids can get through challenges. They can get through stuff that's really hard with just the regular kind of support that they'll have from their family or extended family or from friends. So I think certainly when you're thinking of children and teenagers, I think it's when, you know, a problem really seems to be getting in their way, that it's tripping them up regularly, you know, so that they, you know, maybe they're struggling and they just now can't get into school at all because they feel so anxious about going into school. Or maybe they're having so many problems with friends and falling in and out of friendships and never seem, you know, seeming to be able to kind of settle into friendships. You know, those are the kinds of reasons I think, you know, that you might want to think about getting some extra support when you feel you've exhausted all of your own capacity as a parent. That might be the time to reach out. And just because really coming to see someone like me is, I think, often about just shining a light on an issue from a new angle. So you get a new perspective on it. And that new perspective sometimes then gives you all you need to be able to go kind of deal with the issue. For adults, I think it can be different. I think you don't necessarily have to wait till something is a problem. I mean, I'm not a great ad because I've had the same therapist for the last 23, 24 years. And I wouldn't say I'm, you know, kind of typical by having the same person for so long. So I'm a big fan of proactively just going and, again, just seeking somebody else's perspective. And it just helps you make sense of, typically in adult stuff, I think it helps you make sense of what's your stuff and what's somebody else's stuff, so that, again, you just don't end up kind of getting yourself into situations where you just end up feeling resentful and frustrated and cross because, you know, maybe you've just said yes to the wrong kinds of things, or you feel put upon or obligated to people, and you wonder, how have I managed to fall into that situation again? So I think for adults, I think it can be much more of a kind of a chosen decision that you make, because maybe you're feeling like you're kind of stuck in some way, or maybe you've noticed that some of your habits, particularly if you've noticed that you've, you know, slipped into any of the kind of addictive habits of gambling, you know, and drinking, all that kind of stuff. Typically, those are indicators for us that we are struggling with something at a really deep emotional level. And, you know, the addictive behavior often is the way to keep those feelings at bay, you know, to kind of keep opting out of them. And so those might be indicators of a good time to go and get some help.
And you ever hear people saying, oh, well, that person has an addictive personality? Where is there much truth in that statement?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think people will often move from, you know, addiction to addiction because,
right.
Like, I mean, I, you know, not that necessarily I have any particularly dangerous addictions right now, but like, you know, I've had times when I've gamed to excess. You know, I think if I wanted to, I could certainly start drinking to excess very easily.
Right.
Because I do know that, yeah, it's very easy to just do stuff, and too much of anything becomes a bad thing. And so, I think people will definitely see patterns in their own behavior where they find that they, you know, they throw themselves into something, but then, you know, they absolutely do it to excess. And mobile phones are doing none of us any favors. You know, I think the whole kind of social media world and all that kind of stuff, even for adults, never mind for kids and teenagers, is just, you know, yeah, really addictive. You know, there are some very powerful forces out there, you know, both pharmacologically and physiologically that are going to addict us. And then in terms of behaviors and how humans operate and the AI bots that are, you know, pushing a whole lot of stuff our way as well. Like, it's very easy to fall, I think, into addictions.
Yeah. One of the video clips, anytime I ever hear the word bullying, David, when I'm scrolling through Instagram and doing one of those addictive things that's bad and looking at fast cars, and then your video appears. But that's always one of the ones as a parent that stops me in my tracks, right? But have you ever had it? Because I think the only thing that's worse than bullying is being the parent of the bully. Have you ever had that situation with parents coming to you and they realize that their child is in fact not the one being bullied, but they are themselves the bully?
Sometimes it's rare enough actually, because again, I think, you know, so much of young people's kind of behavior when they fall into targeting other kids or bullying other kids or abusing their power in some way, often it's not restricted. It's not really caught. You know, it's hard, I think, for parents, for schools to address it. And so, I mean, I've had occasional times, yeah, when kids have come, but more often than not, it's the targets of bullying that I've been meeting over the years. And it is hard. It is, you know, really destructive for kids, for their self-esteem, yeah, and so on. And, but yeah, no, I think it's often, oh gosh, I don't know. Nothing's ever that simple. You know, there's often an awful lot going on. But in most situations, you know, the really difficult bit of bullying, if you have somebody who's bullying, is the contempt that they might seem to have for somebody else. It's like they just don't care about the impact of what they're doing. And so they have very little empathy, very little concern, like I say, and probably even a level of contempt for the people that they're picking on. And that's the bit that you're really trying to challenge then when it comes to somebody who is targeting others or who is bullying.
God, it's awful, isn't it? Like, it's the, like, it has to be the, it ha, I don't know, it's just something about bullying. It has to be the saddest thing, like, you know.
And look, we both, Gary and I, work in professions where there is a lot of stress and a lot of different personalities to manage. And I've been lucky enough to use a couple of different coaches through my career. And I kind of wish someone had said it to me earlier in my career, that how much it would have helped using a business coach and using a psychologist to help me navigate through managing a team of people. But like, we work, and the very nature of our job is that we're chasing something that's unachievable, because you're chasing perfection. It's something that's, you're never going to get it. You'll get very close to it at times, and sometimes you feel that you reach it. But I certainly, in my job and my role, it's about managing expectations of everybody that's around me, and managing the young chefs that are coming up, that they're not putting too much emphasis on perfection, but even though you strive for that. And certainly using a business coach and a business psychologist has really helped me in my career. And it's something that I'm a huge advocate of now. And I wish more companies, and I think they are, I think more companies are starting to lean into that world. But also, I've had friends and family around me that have used psychologists for helping kids through difficult stages. And for you, is like, I often wonder with people and anyone listening to this, that when they should reach out. That's the bit, I think, and I know I've asked you that question already, but you know, should you try and do as much of it as you can at home, or should you be reaching into the school and start there, or does it just go on parental gut instinct?
I think your own instinct usually is a good indicator. And certainly if there's two of you at home, or if you have friends or family, and if you're getting the same kind of messages from other people that something seems to be a problem, and you feel it's a problem, and it's a problem that you're struggling to try and resolve or help your child resolve, then absolutely go and get help. Mm. But I was just thinking while you were talking there, Gareth, about the professional kitchens, and I mean, they're very hierarchical in nature. And as you say, you know, if you've got a head chef then who's also chasing their own level of perfection, you know, there's no way to get that often without giving, you know, really specific direction to other people and expecting that the direction is going to be followed to exactly the letter of what you've said. And I think, you know, that then means, doesn't it, that, you know, you've got to be just, I guess, at some other time able to, you know, understand when how you've dished out those directions has been received by somebody else. Because I think there's often a big difference, isn't there, between what we intend to say and what we intend to mean and how somebody else interprets it. And I think that's the bit often where communication falls down and where the dilemmas occur. And it's not necessarily that the content of what we were saying was problematic. It's often the how we said it or why we said it or the way that we've said it in some way. So,
well, it was a psychologist that kind of asked me just to step back a little bit and look at what was going on and maybe start trying to smell the roses a little bit rather than constantly focusing in on what wasn't right and, you know, like looking at all the things that were right and then, you know, just saying, oh, well, that we're doing that really well, but look, this is an area that we really have to focus on. And for me, it was about I was just working way too much. You know, and then I was kind of putting that level of expectation on everybody around me. And anybody that didn't want to do that, then I was kind of going, well, what's wrong? Like, why do they not want to be here morning, noon, and night to get this exactly right? So that was something that I found super helpful. I also think it was part of growing up as a chef. You know, like early head chefs fall into it, get a lot of bad habits very quickly. And I see it time and time and time again throughout our career. And I think it is spoken about better. I think there was loads, and it was nearly at one point you were heroized if you were that chef that shouted and made sure that every, because it was getting pushed on us across media because it was selling TV shows, which isn't what was going on the ground. And now I think the chefs that are celebrated are the ones that are really dialed into making sure their brigade have work-life balance, and you know, they're cooking wonderful food, but they also have a wonderful job outside the kitchen with their families and friends. And I think that's a very positive message. I mean, there's some kitchens that aren't, but I think that's, but also I would also see a lot of young chefs coming into our industry that sometimes are a little lost because they didn't really fit in school. And, you know, when they find food, it can really open up a whole new world to them. And then they'll go, maybe some of the other people that they work with are quite obsessive about something as well. Like, you know, it's something that we have to keep an eye on as head chefs, that they're not getting engulfed by all the information that's being put on them, you know. So it's interesting, and it's certainly something that I think helps from a head chef's point of view when you have somebody telling you about these different areas.
Yeah, and I think there's a big parallel, even, you know, how you describe kind of working with a brigade in a kitchen, you know, and how you're parenting your own family. Because I think, again, if you, you know, as most of us probably do, you know, you find a lot of fault, you find a lot of stuff that your kids aren't doing right. And if that's all we ever focus on, again, it's going to be hard for them. Whereas when we catch them being good, at, you know, and at least provide, if nothing else, the balance, but ideally that it's even tipped in favor of, you know, catching them being good and noticing the good stuff and commenting on it and letting them know that that stuff is appreciated and valued. Because ultimately, certainly for kids, you know, they're always looking for their parents' approval. You know, maybe that's what your brigade is looking for as well. They just want your approval too, you know.
Dishing It Out with Gary O'Hanlon and Gareth Mullins, a Go Loud original podcast.
Proudly sponsored by Johnstone Beef. Explore delicious recipes and discover their premium selection on johnstonebeef.com.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us. Dishing It Out with Gary O'Hanlon and Gareth Mullins, a Go Loud original podcast.
Proudly sponsored by Johnstone Beef, a tradition of Irish dry-aged beef built on 60 years of passion. Learn more at johnstonebeef.com.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us.
How important is failure as a kid, do you think? Yeah, and the reason I'm asking that is, you know, that everybody gets a medal mentality to come in and sport there for a little while. And, you know, when they get into it, like a little bit older and a bit more of a competitive situation, losing became really difficult. Both of my kids play a lot of sport, and I know Gary's kids are the same. So I often wondered years ago when, you know, when, I know when they're babies and they're 5, 6, 7, they're getting in the little kicker camps and stuff. I love to see everybody getting celebrated. But then I feel like at some point someone has to win and someone has to lose, because ultimately that's what sport is. Is that the right train at all for parenting?
Yeah, for sure. And I think, like, I'm a big believer.
Thank God you said that.
Yeah, exactly. You don't have to change everything.
Oh, my God. I'm sitting here sweating, going, no, everybody needs to win.
Your kids aren't going to be fecked.
Yeah.
I'm a big believer that we have to let kids suffer, and actually most people don't let their kids suffer, which is not to say that we're, you know, putting them in harm's way and that we're, you know, causing kind of deep traumatic suffering or letting that happen. It's not, but it's just the commoner garden suffering that I think we protect kids too much from. And of course, if they're protected from all kinds of suffering or protected from failure, then they never learn to be resilient. They never learn the skills of, as you say, coping with the disappointment,
dusting themselves off.
Disappointment doesn't have to be.
And when they do lose, like knuckle rubbing their ear and calling them a loser, is that a step too far? I'm only joking.
Might be a small step too far. Yeah. But then I think, you know, most people don't even name the disappointment. Like, so they see their kids coming off the field and their kids are, you know, really cross or angry, and, you know, and then they're either giving out to the kids for not being, you know, for being cross, and don't be cross, and, you know, you got to be a good loser, as opposed to going, yeah, I can see why you're really cross. I'd say you're crushingly disappointed. Like, that must have been so hard. You'd worked so hard and all the training, and, you know, and you got to the final and you didn't win. Oh, it's really difficult. But it's through that kind of reflective conversations with kids that they actually learn that the disappointments don't have to be crushing, that the disappointments, they hurt a lot. They're very unpleasant. They're very painful, but they're not necessarily going to be something that has to stop you then ever trying again. And I think that's the key thing. And, you know, like if you think of a lot of kids, say with lunchtimes in school, you know, and so, you know, most parents still prepare lunches for their kids, even though that's all about to change. I think certainly in primary school, kids are about to get preschool lunches. But for now, you know, parents are still maybe making lunches for their kids, you know, putting them in the lunchbox and whatever. And if your child forgets their lunchbox and so they leave it on the kitchen counter and they go off to school, you know, most parents, when they see that lunchbox, go, oh my God, you know, they forgot the lunch, and they'll drive into the school after their child, as opposed to going, geez, that's going to be tough now. They're going to be hungry at lunchtime. And I think we're better off not chasing our child into school with the lunchbox, but leaving them to suffer that little bit of, well, I mean, you know, they're not going to die.
It's a couple of hours without a snack.
They're going to be a little bit hungry. And in fact, you know, most schools won't let them go hungry either, because the teacher will say, oh, you know, Johnny's forgotten his lunch today. Let's all share now with Johnny. And the kid in the class going, fucking great, get rid of the apples and bananas.
That
I don't want to eat, you know. So I think, yeah, it's those little kinds of sufferings, you know, the kind of the small things where we come in and we rescue kids too quickly. And it's not that we shouldn't ever rescue a child. Of course, there are times when we should rescue a child, but I think if we do it too soon, then they never learn anything about their own capacity to cope or their own capacity to deal with anything, you know. Like we have, my own examples, even from with my own kids, like we're about five miles or so from the nearest town. And but it's a really busy main road, like country road, and all the twists and turns. And so we never let the kids cycle down to the local town until they hit the age of 12. Then they could cycle down on their own. They could cycle down with us prior to that. But so when my youngest lad, went cycling down shortly after he was 12, he, big deal for him. He came back, bought us sweets, whatever, you know, thrilled. And then there was another day I was at home and I was working and I was seeing clients, and I don't know why he was home from school, but he said to me, oh, can I cycle down? And I said, yeah, of course you can. Yeah, just, you know, remember, because there was a footpath for half of the journey. I said, you know, when you get to the footpath bit, get yourself onto the footpath, because there's this big curb that kind of protected you when you're walking. And I said, make sure you're on the footpath, you know, rather than being on the main road. That's the only, you remember that. But so he said, oh, yeah, off he went. Anyway, I got busy, distracted, didn't really pay much heed. But, you know, it came to 5 o'clock and I suddenly realized when I came down from seeing clients that he wasn't back. And I'm like, oh, that's odd, you know. Anyway, didn't think too much more about it. He arrived home maybe about 10 or 15 minutes later. And, you know, his whole face was kind of covered in blood and he kind of snotted blood all over his shirt. And it turned out that he had, coming back from Killaloo, he had You know, started cycling up the hill, remembered that he should be on the path, decided to cross over and decided to bunny hop the curb, you know, to get onto the path, but of course hit the curb. And so instead went over the front handlebars of the bike, and front wheel of the bike got twisted and whatever. And so a lovely woman stopped, offered to help him. He couldn't remember my number. And so she even offered to drive him home, that she would go home to her house, get her car and come back and drive him. He declined all the help anyway. And so he ended up walking probably about 4 miles back to the house, which is why it took him so long to get home, which is why he wasn't back when he probably should have been earlier. But I can just remember at the time thinking, God, am I like, how that was traumatic, like, you know, because he couldn't even cycle the bike because the wheel was twisted. And but the one message I gave him at the end of all that was, I said, look, you know, the really important thing here is you got home. And you got home all by yourself, and you didn't need that woman. Nice that she stopped. You didn't need me, you know, because you couldn't contact me, and you managed it. And so that means, you know, if you're in similar situations again, you're always going to be able to sort yourself out. I have great faith in you now, and you know, so fair play to you. And so, you know, I like to think that kind of stood to him, you know, and so not that I'd be wishing, you know, that to happen to him again, or that, you know, he was in that kind of pain, but I think it's just that sense that kids need to know that they can cope with stuff and that they'll be fine out the other end of it.
Yeah. And how many kids have you, David? Are they, is 12?
Three.
Yeah. And what's the age?
So my eldest is now 26. My middle daughter is, so my eldest is a lad and he's 26. Then we have a daughter who's going to be turning 24 this year, and in November, and our youngest is 20.
Oh, wow. Yeah. So, yeah. And have you ever found yourself dishing out advice to families that you maybe didn't heed yourself when they were teenagers or whatever, or have you always been resolute? Yeah.
Never. Yeah. Gary, geez, I'm surprised you'd even suggest such a thing. God almighty. No.
Always no, perfect parenting.
I absolutely have. And, you know, and my wife would tell me the same thing. You know, I think my wife is a lot more of a steadying influence in our own family. And, you know, I do have a tendency to be, I would say I'm quite critical, you know, and it's not very helpful, certainly for my kids growing up, I don't think, you know, and I mean, I track it back sometimes. And I mean, I do remember, you know, the phrase, if a job is worth doing, it's worth doing. What word would you fill in for the last word of that?
Quickly.
If a job is worth
well,
doing, what did you say?
Quickly.
Worth doing right. Worth doing right.
Yeah. We're doing well.
Yeah, you see, so there you go. There's the two options, right and well. And so my dad was a big believer that if a job was worth doing, it was worth doing right. And so that means there's a wrong way to do it. And so, you know, I certainly felt the effects of doing things wrong growing up. And I think I had the same attitude towards my own kids. And if you take the different finish, though, if you know, if a job is worth doing, you know, it's worth doing well. What that really means is you should put all your effort into it. You should work really hard. You should commit to it. You should invest in it and you try your best. And so, you know, that gives you the scope as well to fail. That allows you then to know that even when you work really hard, sometimes it doesn't pan out. Whereas if when things don't work out, you get, you know, punished or given out to or criticized because it's not done right, then that tends to take away probably some of your internal motivation. And so, I mean, I know for sure, like it's very hard being a parent, full stop. That much I've absolutely decided. It's just hard. Yeah. So I have great empathy for a lot of my clients and my clients' parents. But I also think too, it's impossible to be, to get it right all the time, you know, even when you know the theory of it. And I feel I do know the theory of it, but that's not to say that's happened in practice. And I know.
Yeah, because there's so many variables, like every kid reacts a different way. And
yeah,
some messages they take on board, others they just, you know, there's just no.
Yeah.
Do you deal with any of the, just because of what you're on dishing it out, do you deal with much kids having struggles with food?
Not so much now, because it's coming. It's mostly teenagers that I deal with. But right. I mean, the irony, you know, there was a time certainly, and like when I wrote my first book, you know, and I wrote the chapter on food, it was for kind of preschoolers and toddlers and babies. That's what the book was about, parenting those. And so there was a whole section on it on you know, eating. And but like I was such a fussy eater growing up. Like the irony of it, you know, and like I used to eat cornflakes sausages and toast and mashed potatoes, and it didn't really matter what order you gave
or when it was served,
time of the day. so long as it was one of those four, I was kind of happy, and that would constitute a meal for me. And then I went to France when I was 16 on a school tour or school exchange, and it was a 3-week exchange. And so I remember being in France, and the mam, when I think of it, like, she was a fabulous cook, and they used to have the long kind of lunch breaks. I presume that's still the case in France. So everybody kind of came home at lunchtime from school. So I would walk home from school in France and come in, and there'd be this, like, you know, all the different dishes came out as like a single course. So I remember, you know, there was this beautiful dish of creamed spinach that came out, and I remember looking and thinking, okay, is this the only thing now, or will there be something else that I might eat? Because I'm not going to eat that, because that's kind of green and dodgy looking. And you know, and so what I quickly realized was that I actually probably would have starved and died had I not changed my eating. And so I started to eat everything that this mom cooked, much to my own mother's horror that some other mother got the benefit of her son finally stretching out his wings and trying different foods. But I think it was absolutely transformational for me, and to the point now that I actually have a really broad, wide palate, you know, and love food and love cooking food and love eating. And, you know, thankfully my kids have grown up with much the same, you know, kind of willingness to try stuff with different kinds of foods. But I have over the years, dealt with kids, but mostly young kids. And, you know, my big thing for parents, though, is just not to try and force kids to eat, because I think if you focus instead on food being a kind of a social experience for kids, and that if they eat something, great. If they don't, that's fine. That, you know, they'll pick up something else later on. And as long as your store of food is good, healthy, nutritious kinds of foods, and it's not all super processed stuff, then if they choose not to eat at mealtimes, that's not the biggest deal. You know, make the mealtimes still to be fun if they're young kids, or make the mealtimes just about, you know, sitting down, having a good chat if it's older kids and teenagers. And and I think that just takes the pressure off the food element of it, and means that kids don't use food as their kind of power tool to fight with you, because that's ultimately what happens. It's not really about food at all. It's mostly about power and who has the power.
No, it's good, because it's something that I know Gary and I would get asked a lot. Oh, my kids don't eat, what should I do, or whatever. And I'm glad to hear your advice, because I would just be like, just make sure they're eating something, you know, like if the things that they eat great, and then slowly introduce, put things on the table. Hopefully they'll just grab at it, or, you know, and obviously if in couples, sometimes one of the parents are probably a fussy eater themselves. They just don't admit it. And I'm like, do you expect your kids to eat all this stuff and you don't eat it? So it's kind of a little bit strange, you know, so I'd see that a lot.
You see a lot of families now, more so even than my sense of it when I was growing up, but a lot of families now where parents eat separately to their kids, you know, so they prepare food for their kids and then they might eat later, you know, because
life,
work commitments or whatever. And so I think that's difficult, because kids need to see parents eating as well. They need to see that this stuff is safe to eat, and they need the modeling from their parents. And they need, like you say, they need to see that their parents have this broad appetite for different kinds of foods and different preparations for foods and all this kind of stuff. That's what helps kids then to realize, oh, okay, I can afford to be a little bit adventurous in what I'm doing here.
And so you said you're a keen cook. So do you do most of the cooking?
I do at this stage, you know, mostly because it's convenient. Like, I work from home. And so, you know, my day, when it finishes at 5 or whatever, that's it finished. You know, if I'm finished seeing clients, I don't have a commute, whereas my wife is working with the HSE. So, so she's typically later home than I am. So it's just, it's more convenient for me to cook. But I mean, I enjoy cooking and I'm a bit of a control freak, courtesy of my dad again, maybe. And so I like the food that I cook, you know, and I like the way that I cook it. So, that's probably part of it.
Good man. And you're adventurous. Will you try different things, or what does the repertoire look like? Is it all sorts of different dishes, or?
Yeah, I mean, the repertoire at home now, it's amazing how, you know, routine just falls into place. I mean, I'd say there are certain meals that we tend to eat. Like, we've always had pizza on a Friday in our house, just always, from when the kids were tiny. And it's just been the thing. And, you know, there was a stage when we were you know, making the dough as well as making the tomato sauce, as well as, you know, preparing all the toppings and whatever. You know, I've gotten to the stage now where I don't bother making the dough anymore. There's other people make it quite well and it's been prepared.
Yeah, exactly.
But I'd still go to the trouble of making my own tomato sauce and stuff and yeah, mixing up the toppings. We've fallen into routine, which is why I think now that the kids are gone, it's great because we can kind of go out a bit more. It gets very expensive going out when your kids are in their teenage years because they eat like adults and they have zero money. You know?
That's the stage of life I'm at with my two. Mine are 14, yeah, 17.
Like we were, our daughter's, as I say, is heading off to America at the start of November, and my wife was saying, so we'll have to arrange a dinner. Like, we'll have to get up to Dublin now and have a dinner. I was like, can they not come down? Like, because then I can cook. Whereas if we go up to Dublin, like, that's, you know, 300-400 euros. The five of us, never mind the girlfriends on tow. But but it's nice now because we can go out, and so we get variety in our meals when we go out, whereas my wife's a vegetarian as well, and I'm not, so that means she ends up kind of batch cooking stuff for herself as well. And even though I'll obviously happily prepare stuff for her too, but so it's kind of,
and you're about to take the show on the road on a live tour, we see.
Well, I'm in the middle of it, actually.
Oh, okay.
I think I'll be, certainly in terms of days, I'll be halfway through by the time this podcast probably comes out. Because I've been up to Letterkenny and Ennis and places like that. I've still to get to. I think I'm going to be in Limerick the night that this comes out.
Yeah, we see you're down in Limerick on the 16th, and then you're Waterford, Cork, Dundalk, Kilkenny. Yeah. Blanche and Dunleary, they're sold out, unfortunately.
So is Cork, actually, now.
Oh, brilliant.
Limerick is nearly sold out.
Expect to see when they go to see it in a live show?
So the tour is, I suppose the tour came about because I gave a talk last year in Sheam Satira down in Tralee on helping kids and teenagers to cope with anxiety. And I think I was surprised by how well received it was. I was surprised that it sold out. And so I thought, okay, maybe there is actually, you know, a greater need than I perceived. And again, I think it comes back to that idea of giving psychology away. Like, you know, I do get asked to come and give talks, and I give lots of parenting talks, and then I do various corporate talks, but that's usually at whatever somebody else wants. And so this was an opportunity for me to think, okay, well, this is something I think people need, actually. And so, I talked for about an hour and a quarter on the theme of anxiety and really practical stuff on how
that's
to help
brilliant.
Kids deal with anxiety.
Is there more anxiety in society now, or is it just more recognized? Or, you know, I often think of when I grew up in school and there was people in my class and things going on around me that now when I think back, I'm like,
well, I'll tell you what, right, let me jump in there. I don't know, David, you're probably very familiar with, well, your kids are much older, but there's a cartoon movie, one of those called, is it Inside Out? Well, yeah. Inside Out 2 came out before the summer or whatever it was. The first one was brilliant. It was all about the mind or whatever, all these different characters with different sort of feelings and whatnot. But I came home at the summer, I just see now it's on Disney as of last week or whatever. But I remember coming back in the beginning of the summer and my wife Annette saying to me, oh, what did you make of that? And I said, whoever wrote that is a genius, because they incorporated, obviously the characters were now older, they were maybe teenagers, and they incorporated a character with anxiety called anxiety. And I just thought it was the most up-to-date, in-tune, genius little things, because my daughter's, she's 10 now, like, but was probably 7 maybe when the first one came out or whatever it was. But it's just mad how, all if you'd watched the first one and now the second one, like, it really is a reflection of society and what's going through their mind, you know. But yeah, just once Gareth mentioned anxiety there, it tapped into that.
And so do you feel, David, there is more of it around at the moment, or is it just more
So I think it's there's a couple of things I think that are significant. Like I do think anxiety has become somewhat pathologized in kind of the discourse at the moment. And so, you know, if I have teenagers coming who get anxious to the clinic here, that, you know, they will say to me very confidently, I have anxiety, like I have COVID or I have some other illness. Whereas, you know, I'd never get a, well, not necessarily that teenagers are always in a good mood, but I wouldn't get anybody coming to me saying I have happiness, you know, and yet, you know, anxiousness and feeling anxious has become categorized as a condition. And I'm not sure that that's a very helpful way to look at it. And so, I mean, I think there are certainly more things that our kids are exposed to that are likely to provoke anxiety in them. You know, if you look at the instability in the world, it's really prevalent, but also really, you know, kind of, I suppose, evident for kids because of the way stuff is now, you know, all over the internet, and they have the internet in their pocket often. And so that means that they're exposed to a lot more of that kind of global uncertainty. I think, you know, social media and all that kind of stuff itself adds to kids' anxiety hugely. So I'm not sure that there is necessarily, you know, more kids who have anxiety as a condition. But I think, you know, lots of kids will feel anxious. But I think we're, a lot of parents are also kind of misreading that now, misinterpreting it, and making it into something that's worse than it is for those kids. I think, you know, we need to go back to recognizing that, you know, kids will feel anxious. Of course they will. There'll be lots of things that'll happen in the world or in their experience that they'll feel anxious about. That's okay. Like any other feeling, it's going to come and it's going to go. And there's probably things that a child can do to reduce the intensity of it. But I think if we start giving them this sense, or they start picking it up themselves from TikTok and wherever, that they have anxiety, then it becomes something that they feel powerless, that they can't deal with, that they can't regulate, or that they can't manage in some way. So I think that's significant, you know, and yeah, whereas in truth, there's a lot that we can do when we feel anxious.
And I think labelling has kind of become a real thing, hasn't it, in recent culture? Like, oh yeah, if there's something going on, you have to find out what it is, what it's called, and then you give that to yourself, which I'm never really very comfortable with that, to be honest.
And
learning the skills to get through it is the way to manage it, but anyway.
Yeah, and I think, you know, for kids as well, you know, older kids now and teenagers will certainly self-diagnose based on, you know, TikTok often and what they're coming up with. And you're right, labeling. I mean, I, of course, have a bit of a love-hate relationship with labeling. I mean, I see all the dilemmas that it creates, and yet as a professional, I can see also how it's so
positive
useful
parts,
as a shortcut to understanding, you know, what a child's needs might be. But I think the danger is always that we just focus on the label and not on the child who underlies that. And that's the real difficulty. If labels are being fired about and kids get labeled, it's almost like they then can't operate outside of whatever.
You can't shake it almost.
Yeah, it's like that's all we see them as opposed to seeing them as the whole child and seeing that this is one area of challenge for them, for sure. But we're not seeing the whole child, and we need to see the whole child. A bit like you were saying earlier, you know, you can't just focus on the negative. You've got to see the positives as well. And so with kids who have specific challenges because they've got disabilities of whatever kind, or they're, you know, neurodiverse or whatever it might be, we can't just see them that's their defining characteristic. We have to see them more broadly.
Well, we have a closing tradition on the podcast where we ask people their death row meal or their last supper, if you will. And it's what's the last bit of grub that me and Gary were going to cook for you, let's put it that way. What's the last thing you want us to cook for you? Either three courses, one course, whatever floats your boat. It kind of gives us a little bit of an insight into your psychology as a person.
So I'd go two courses and a coffee, but I'd be really fucking particular about my coffee.
All right. of course. We've got that from you so far.
Do you know what it is? It's not even the coffee. It's the water that it's made with.
Oh, well.
This is where my pure coffeeness has come out. Because so I have a nice Gaggia machine here at home.
Well.
And I drink regular Lavazza coffee, but I always I make it, obviously we have a well because we're in the country, and so our water is particularly nice. And I've drunk Lavazza in my kids' houses and flats up in Dublin and whatever.
It's not the same.
Never tastes the same. It just doesn't taste the same.
This is what I love about this question. We get right under the nitty gritty of what floats your boat. So
there you are. Well, anyway, so make sure you got good quality water. I'll send it down if needed. So that's the end of it. So I would start with, this is great. So I would start with a prawn dish of some kind as my starter. And I don't mind. I love any kind of like a prawn pilpil or something with a bit of spicing and just, yeah.
Delicious. So
that'll be a starter. And then my main course. So I got, I don't often eat in like really nice restaurants, but I occasionally get to go to really nice restaurants. And the thing I most love when I go to a really nice restaurant and they have steak on the menu is when they say, and I'd order the steak if it's on the menu. So that would be my main course would be steak, fillet steak. But when they ask, you know, how would you like your steak served or cooked?
Mm.
And I will always say, if it's a nice restaurant, I will always say, well, whatever way the chef likes to cook it.
Yeah.
And then you just get the most amazing steak. And I feel like, yeah. Anyway, so that would be it. So probably, yeah.
Man,
I guess,
from my own heart.
Kind of rare.
Yeah, medium, but, rare or rare. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So I'd have steak and then I would have, I love, yeah, I don't know. I'd go steak and chips with, as long as they're nice, proper, actual homemade chips, not your dodgy.
No skinny fries. Yeah.
No skinny fries or no, pre-packaged. I just, you know.
Real spuds.
We do a lot of stuff, you know. I mean, this, are we an ingredient house or are we a whatever house? We've always just cooked with, you know, made stuff from scratch as much as possible. And so, yeah, I'd be particular again about how.
Well, when you say you fetch your own water from the well every morning to make coffee, I have no doubt that you source your ingredients correctly. Because that's what good food is all about.
We do have electricity, so we do.
Okay. Yeah. I have these visions of you putting on your little roundy glasses, walking up the garden with a bucket, you know.
Gareth never leaves Dublin, David. He doesn't understand the concept of a well. No, he's just a city slicker. He's
good news, Gareth, is that there's pure quality out there somewhere. You just have to go to the garden to find it.
Just have to walk down the end of the garden.
Yeah.
I get it.
Yeah.
Well, look, David, thank you so much. I really enjoyed that conversation. I knew it would be insightful. And from two parents and three parents here sitting in the studio, I love hearing not the simplistic approach, but the trust in your gut instinct is what good parenting. And to be honest with you, it's what good cooking is about as well. So I think that's a nice way to wrap up the show. Thanks so much for your time today.
Yeah, pleasure.
Okay, Gar, so we had David, and like I literally could listen to his voice all day. I can really understand why he works in the world that he is, and he really is a fountain of knowledge, but a well of knowledge, I think, is what I would say.
A well of knowledge, yeah, bum, bum.
Yeah. We're here all week, I was excellent, eh?
Yeah, no, good guy, yeah, it's very interesting, and it was so funny, actually. He just went from being all prim and proper to like, don't make my coffee without fucking good water. I was like, all right, calm down, doc.
Yeah, but I suppose it's a world now, it must be, well, your kids going through something and then being able to reach out to somebody like him to help give you the skill set and the tools to navigate. Which is,
I mean, I hope I never ever need him, but the chances are high at some point.
Yeah, but also, you know, I think, and I do, like, being in school years ago, there was definitely kids around me now that the knowledge that I've learned through my life that needed a dig out and they weren't getting it for whatever reason, you know. So all of that type of, especially when it comes to kids getting help, I think it's so important. And his little nuggets of information that he shares on his socials are definitely worth a follow. If you're not following him, go and have a look, because I'm sure you'll pick up little bits and pieces along the way. So look, he was a brilliant guest and I think our listeners are going to really enjoy it. That being said, Ed, over to you, Miel Flower, with the culinary conundrums. What have we got?
Voice of David Coleman to this mess.
Yeah, you're a little under the weather, but come on.
We'll get through it. So, love the show. Best podcast I listen to. It would be great if you could answer a question for me. Long ago, living in the States, I used to order a port cheddar burger. Essentially, the sauce was more paste-like, but was a combo of the two flavors. Despite countless attempts, I can't bring the two together in a solid fashion to sit on a burger. Any advice appreciated. Donal, P.S. Looking forward to my dinner in Forbes Street before the All Blacks game in November.
Oh, good man.
Carry what did he say? A port and cheddar?
So, port cheddar burger.
Port cheddar burger. The only thing I could think on is it's... maybe like it's possibly like Lyonnaise finished with pork.
I was going to say to you, the only, if someone asked me to make that, I would make some onion marmalade.
Yeah.
Bonnet used port as the Gary shared a brilliant recipe a few weeks ago of those onions where you put in the mustard seeds, yes, and everything. But I would just be making, sauteing my onions down, and I would deglaze that with lots of port. Mm. And it really, where we normally use that type of onion marmalade is with like a terrine or with some chicken liver parfait, but it'd be delicious on a burger with a real sharp cheddar.
That's great, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm just thinking about it now. Yeah,
I'd say it was probably a restaurant that he ate in that was just a bit of a signature in a restaurant, possibly.
Yeah, I mean,
I don't know.
Even if he emails in and tells us where he ate it or in the States, because I could even look at it. But just off the top of my head, make me a port and cheddar burger. That's exactly what I'd be doing. I'd be making a port infused Lyonnaise onion, and then I'm putting a real mature cheddar on top of that. That'll melt right into the port onions.
Yeah, it sounds good.
And stick that on top of a burger. Yeah.
That now subconsciously, I'll make that next week. And I'll wonder why, and I'll be like,
bring it in, lads. What are you talking about? Come on. Thanks, Total. Our next conundrum. Hi, Gary and Gareth. I hope this question makes sense. Oh, here we go. I find myself rushing through recipes and not getting the results I want. Are there certain steps, like letting meat rest or deglazing a pan, that I should slow down on to improve the overall flavour? Love the pod, Dorina in Mayo.
That's why it's called a recipe, Dorina.
Yeah, and I think when you're talking to people about cooking, sometimes the jargon around it is what people struggle with, and they don't realise the importance. Like, resting meat isn't necessarily going to give it more flavour. That's really a textural thing, you know. So when you rest meat, you're trying to get the protein to like calm down or rest.
And it eats in its best form.
Just eat nicer, you know. And then when it comes to flavour, deglazing the pan, even if you don't know what you're doing, once you add the liquid into it, that's what it's going to do. It's going to take all the little bits that stuck to the bottom. So I would say you're well on the road, but maybe if there's a word in a recipe that you don't understand, and a lot of the time it's probably because it's jargon and it's like it's an industry word, just throw it into Google and ask exactly what it is and just read the print.
But the real thing really is like you get out what you put in. Mm. So if you're looking for shortcuts in the cooking, you're going to taste the shortcut. You know what I mean? Like in our world, there's processes for flavor, and flavor sometimes takes time. So yeah, there's loads of little cowboy tricks. We would call it cowboy moves, whereby, you know, you're in the weeds and you got to shave time off something. There's lots of little tips and tricks you can do to speed something up. But in your heart of hearts, you'll be like going, oh, that could have been fucking better. Okay. You know what I mean? Like, so shortcuts are tasted.
Well, we'll finish with that. Nice one, Gary. Hey lads, it's my favourite cooking time of the year, stew season, and here's my conundrum. I often end up with bland stews or casseroles. Can you suggest a specific technique for layering flavours with herbs and spices throughout the cooking process, rather than just adding them at the end? Thanks, Emil. Damien Riley in Longford.
Damien O'Reilly.
Stock Cube Damien is probably going to be our best friend when it comes. And I think sometimes people have a little bit of a... they think it's like a bad word or whatever, like not making your own. The reality is home cooking, those stock cubes will just lift the flavour for you. If you follow the things like by searing off the meat and chopping your vegetables correctly and sautéing it and seasoning all through the stages, that will help with all of that. But generally speaking, people then add water into what they're doing, where in a professional kitchen, the only time you ever add water to anything is to bones and to vegetables to make a stock. And then that stock is the flavour vessel to make the stew. So at home, when you add in water to something, then you need to go into a stock cube or two. And it will elevate whatever it is that you're going to be eating, I would say.
And then you're chatting there about adding stuff at the end. Like say you're making a tangine, or you're making like a lamb curry, or you're making a sweet potato, or whatever. Say it's something like with aromatic spices, whether it's a Middle Eastern dish or if it's more of an Asian dish and it's a curry, whatever it'll be. And you're like, let's go right back as far as the marination. Like say you know, you've got chicken and you've got some smoked paprika whisked into yogurt, a little bit of salt and pepper and that. Then you season the diced up bits of chicken. You sit that in buttermilk or you sit it in yogurt. It's adding to the flavor. It's fusing right inside the meat. Okay. And then you go to cook and you follow whatever recipe it may be. Say it's lamb and you've made your own Ras Helanout. Like, that means top of the shop. Every little spice blend place in Morocco, at the till you'd have a Ras Helanout. It's like a house blend, for example. You've got that rubbed into your diced up lamb before you're making a tagine. There is absolutely no world where you don't do any of that spicing or any of that marination, and you just cook diced raw lamb and you cook it, and then at the end you feed in a load of Ras Helanout or paprika or cumins or spices, that's going to be in any way close to as nice as the one that's been marinated and the spices have been dry roasted in the pan when you're cooking the meats. It is always the earlier you can get them flavors infused into the meat will always be a better end product. Always, always.
Great stuff. Thank you, Damien. And thank you to everyone for sending in their conundrums. Don't forget, keep them rolling into us, please, at food@goloudnow.com.
Okay. Well, first of all, Ed, I hope you're feeling a little bit better next week.
I really hope so as well.
Yeah, yeah. Another show, Gary, and look, a fun packed show this week. So as always, we'd like to just throw a little shout out to our sponsors of Dishing It Out, and that's Johnstone Beef. So make sure, they still have a couple of those boxes left. So if you're going on to johnstonebeef.com, you will use the checkout code of Gary
JSBDO.
And now that's a running gag between me and Gary, so I'm never going to say that again. That's his gig. So look, tune in next week and we'll talk to you then.
Dishing It Out with Gary O'Hanlon and Gareth Mullins, a Go Loud original podcast.
Proudly sponsored by Johnstone Fine Foods. Get premium Irish dry-aged beef delivered to your home at johnstonebeef.com.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us.